Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have an exciting show. We have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the UFO updates in just a minute. And after that, we have Jordan Bonaparte from Canada. He's going to be talking about something that he's working on, pretty interesting. It's called UFOs Above Canada. He does a great show called The Nighttime Podcast. And after that, about 45 minutes into the show, we're going to be talking to Ellie Maloney. Now, she is a former lawyer. She's actually going to be talking to us from Europe, so she's staying up late. And she has written a book that's really interesting. It's science fiction, but it's really good and a lot of really good reviews, and we'll be talking about that. And she knows a little bit about some UFO cases, which kind of inspired part of her book. We're going to be talking about that as well. So I want to thank you for supporting the show. And if you can't support the show and want to listen to the full shows, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to 10 p.m. and watch there, or the YouTube, our YouTube channel, or on the Dark Matter Digital Network. That's Thursday nights from 10 until midnight. And speaking of the Dark Matter Digital Network, Art Bell. We lost Art Bell last week, and Alejandro is going to be on. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you, sir. Always lovely to be here.
Yes. Good to have you on, as always.
I'm off planet.
Yes, we're going to see that in just a second here. The YouTube.
Oh, okay.
There you are. You are off planet. Yeah, we had a meltdown last week on YouTube. We had downloaded software. I mean, whatever you call it. We updated software on our Mac, and that was history for this program. Had to wipe the Mac completely clean and start all over from scratch and have an older version on. So we just got, I mean, it was hours and hours, 2 days worth of work, but we're on with no glitches right now so far.
So far.
Just like having a new computer. But anyway, it's all fixed, and I love the background now. What is that, a great big like poster or something behind you?
No, it's a planet. It's the hallway. You see kind of a, I think this is kind of like an air, or like just kind of a hallway in a spacecraft.
Oh, you're and on then, a spacecraft.
And beyond that, yeah, you do see some planets. And I'm not even sure where we're at, but somewhere out in the vast wild beyond.
Wow, and you have internet, which is really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the internet's great.
Got really good signal out there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to expand you so they can see the whole picture of the YouTube watchers in just a second.
Okay.
So I just mentioned Art Bell. You want to lead off talking about Art?
Yeah, so unfortunately, Art Bell passed away fairly recently. Funny enough, this guy came up, Kevin Johnson, in my podcast on a different issue, but I actually found out from him first very quickly. I guess most people found out because the local police had posted that this had happened. And so one of the viewers, listeners, posted that on our Open Mind UFO group, and within an hour of that happening, so we found out fairly quickly. I guess there's not a lot of information about how or exactly what he passed from. I guess he was 72 years old, so very sad. Of course, he's a legend. You know, a lot of people don't know. We talked about this in the last show. Yeah, a couple neat points that and I found this out from George Knapp, that actually Robert Bigelow is who helped him get his beginning. Robert and George Knapp and some others were involved with talking him into doing this, and they helped fund it. And I guess it was a small thing local there, but of course it grew and got huge. And essentially, you know, if you were listening to the radio overnight, you were listening to Art Bell pretty much for many, many years, including when I was growing up and probably when you were a little younger too. So, but it's, I guess people don't seem to be too shocked. He was older, but sad. It is a little early, you know, your 70s. These days people live past that. But another really cool thing that was posted this week was from Bryce Zabel. So Bryce is awesome, Hollywood guy. He spoke at our conference this last year, and he actually was the producer and writer of a TV series called Dark Skies, which was essentially NBC's answer to X-Files. However, it was based off of, you know, actual kind of research, what people suspect to be the truth of what's going on. And there was all this Majestic 12 and everything. Well, when he had a scene where all the Majestic 12 people were together, Art Bell was cast as one of the Majestic 12. And he actually has a few speaking lines, and it's a really great clip.
Wow. Yeah, I saw something about that. Now, on on Midnight in the Desert, they have a little bit about Art's final ride, rest in peace. And they say that it's probably due likely to complications from his diagnosed COPD. I don't know exactly what that stands for. It's a chronic obstructive
with the heart.
Yeah, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So anyway, he was an icon. I think he opened the door for, well, for this show, for so many shows, actually. You know, a lot of people were inspired by him. And one of the things I heard him say often was, if you're going to do it, just be yourself. You know, that's all you have to do is just be yourself on air. And he was very, very good at that. Very natural.
I think that's the key. And that's what people want. I don't think you have to do a lot of showmanship and everything. You don't have to, you know, go off planet and try
like you
to impress people. You know, that way you just have to be yourself. And he was, I mean, you can tell he had a genuine curiosity. It's very nice to guess. And he was a thinker, you know, he was always contemplating and thinking, and that was fun about his show, which he was always kind of putting out scenarios of what if this or what if that. You can tell he was very, very curious. And so he felt like, you know, he felt like one of you, someone that was just really into the topic and really curious about what's going on, like many of us who are compelled to do this.
That's right.
And so, yeah, so he was a mentor for many of us, and it's sad that he's gone. And I'm sort of bummed too that I never got to meet him or talk to him personally. Did you?
I never actually talked to him, only communicated through email. I came really, really close. It's kind of a funny story, but anyway, I was out of range when he was going to call. I was at a lake, unfortunately, and missed a call. And
wow.
But anyway, it was just one of those situations.
Yeah, because you were on his network. I mean, you still are.
Yeah, I'm on his network. On just now a recorded show on his network. But I started out live on his network and was actually helped Heather Wade, who took over his place, actually as her producer for a little while. So I got to know and Keith Rowland, great people over there. So it was an interesting experience. It was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's it's a big loss, and he will certainly be missed. He's an icon, almost hard to believe he's gone. And actually, you do hear a lot of his shows playing. And if you go on YouTube for anything right now, you'll see Art Bell come up right away, you know, his old shows. So long may he live that way.
Right.
Yeah. So what else is happening in space?
Well, you know, what's interesting on these spacecraft, and now you can buy them online, is these UFO Congress mugs. Look how cool that is.
Oh, wow.
You can find that at the UFO Congress store. That's what I'm out here doing, is bartering with some of the locals of the planet that you can see over my shoulder here. And they create this incredible technology that's perfect for mugs. It looks like ceramic, but...
Wow.
Yeah,
amazing.
Key technology. So you could get that at the Congress website. But anyways, other news. Tom Reed. So Tom Reed, some of you may remember. Have you had him on your show?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes. Not too long ago.
Yeah, so you've had him on the show.
He and I both had trouble getting out to the Congress out there during snowstorms that year. Remember when he was late coming
out?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was late. Luckily, he got out there. I think it was last year. He was a speaker. But he's had this experience in I can't remember where it is, Michigan?
I thought it was
Massachusetts,
wasn't it?
Oh, you're right. You're right. It's Massachusetts. But when he was a kid, this happened. There was a sighting. It was in 1969. It was actually in Blue Book. Alan J. Hynek felt it was a very important sighting. But what a lot of people don't know is that during this sighting, you know, Tom Reed and his family, he says they had an abduction experience. And he goes into detail. He and his brother have been on several television shows. He's in Roswell every year. Maybe he'll be there this year. I'll be there. And at the UFO Museum there doing talks. But he got a monument put up where his event occurred, and it's near a bridge, and one of these old bridges, like it reminds me of bridges of Madison County, you know, those sort of nice, quaint little bridges.
Like
and,
a covered bridge or something, right?
Was yeah, covered bridge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Near this bridge. And what happened is, I guess the monument's on city land, and they didn't like that. So soon after that got put up, just a couple years ago, they made him move it. Well, now they're making him move it again. Again, they put it on private property, but I guess it's on an easement. So he's got to move it from there. And he's upset. He's saying the person who's making him move it is the one who chose the current location. So
jeez,
I guess maybe they're getting some negative feedback. I know originally some of the locals said, I don't want to go visit the bridge and have to, you know, deal with this alien UFO stuff. But what's interesting are a couple things. Of course, we covered this before, I think, is that his monument and his event got recognized by the historic society out there. So it is documented, which is really cool. But this story of him having to move this monument for some reason or other has made headlines all over the nation. I mean, it's on all of these big newspapers. I think I saw it on U.S. News and World Report, but I'm still seeing these links to it. So it's made big news. So, it's interesting that it should. At least it brings awareness to the event that occurred. So it's a good thing for him. But yeah, a lot of press him having to move this monument.
It is, and it's 5,000 pounds, by the way, of concrete.
It is huge. Yes, it's really big. Another story that I think is really interesting, and I know we've touched on this before, but it's just not going away, and it's escalated a bit, and that's the Atacama humanoid story. So
it's back?
It's back, and it's huge in that it was only a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that Dr. Nolan, the guy who did the DNA work, who was actually, I guess he volunteered to help Greer out, and Greer's like, great, here's my DNA guy. And this is Dr. Greer that, you know, he's famous for doing all of this UFO stuff. But, Greer claims this thing's an alien, and Dr. Nolan said, oh, no, actually we found out it's human. So there's been some back and forth there. But what's most interesting is this ethical question that's now arisen, and it's kind of the ethics of anthropology and taking the bodies. Now they're kind of getting in trouble, him and the colleagues he got to kind of do this research to figure out what was going on with this weird fetus that was found in Chile in the Atacama Desert. And now people are questioning, should they have done this research? Should they, should scientists, are they responsible for figuring out the origins of the fetus and then doing what's right, influencing the owner then to, you know, do whatever the correct thing is. And now the Chilean government is involved and they're upset and they want that fetus back. I don't know if that's going to happen. I guess the owner that Greer first got this from, he's a guy in Spain. He now has it back. But they've gotten in a little bit of hot water, and it's this big kind of academic debate and thing that's going on about the ethics of you know, what you do with carcasses that, you know, come from third world countries or you know, before you do your scientific research. Nolan has argued that they have made some scientific headway on this and that they've been able to understand a little better the anomalies, the diseases, essentially, that this thing had. It looks like this thing really never survived. It was a onboard fetus. But so it's become this big thing. So it's really interesting. I mean, this whole UFO alien investigation has now become this mainstream scientific issue about the ethics of working on these carcasses.
Wow, interesting, huh?
Yeah. So this latest story, by the way, was in Cosmos about this, and that's kind of the nature. It was kind of this silly little thing that people were like, oh, you know, these people believe this is alien, and they have Greer saying, no, it's still an alien, this is a conspiracy. And Dr. Nolan and his colleagues saying, well, we found out that it's human, but it has all of these weird issues. It's evolved from this cute little story to kind of these, then it got these kind of ethical undertones, and now it's become this big ethics issue.
Wow, interesting, huh?
Yeah. That's wow. Really weird.
And there's so many, you know, I'm glad they're stopping. It's almost like they're raiding these, you know, caverns where these tombs are. So,
well, a lot of them are just out in the desert. It's a very dry desert. Yeah, it's one of the things. And that's why we get, you know, this keeps happening. This show Gaia, you know, unfortunately, yeah. They've gotten into this. Of course, they're a huge like yoga company where they have yoga accessories and clothing and stuff, and they've gotten into kind of the new age stuff, and they've gotten some really hokey terrible stuff from the UFO world yet again, these bodies from the desert out there. And this happens periodically because the bodies are well preserved because it's a very dry desert,
right?
And they look weird, so sometimes they'll get uncovered from wind or whatever, and people will say, oh, that looks like an alien, and then they try to purport it's an alien. Jaime Musan's been through this.
Yeah.
And this whole thing happened. So that's why that this region is kind of ripe for this sort of thing. And now they're kind of done. They're like, look, we are done with people claiming that our ancestors are aliens. They're just and nobody should be messing with the bodies in the first place. And you know, they have a good argument.
Right, right. Well, Alejandro, thank you. I think that's going to do it, unless you have something else pressing.
I think that is all for now.
All right, excellent. Talk to you next week.
All right, talk to you next week, buddy.
All right. So our guest now is going to be Jordan Bonaparte, and we've had him on the show previously. Great guy, and does an excellent podcast called The Nighttime Podcast. And so he is on with us now. Welcome to the show, Jordan.
It's great to be back, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So, hey, you're doing something coming up called UFOs Over Canada. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you about it. It's really like, as you mentioned, I have a show now called Nighttime. And on Nighttime, I examine and explore Canadian mysteries and true crime. And I do a lot of UFO stories. Like I've kind of over the last few years, I've done episodes kind of covering kind of the main Canadian UFO events. But I was looking for a way to really expand on that, where again, I've covered the big things like, you know, like Shag Harbor and whatnot. But I kind of wanted to dive into the type of UFO experiences that the people you work with have, and just kind of like the everyday UFO experiences. Like I find, having covered the UFO phenomenon a lot, I'll chat with people and everybody has a story like, you know, my uncle saw a UFO or my brother saw a UFO, or sometimes it's I saw a UFO, you know, back in high school or something like that. So mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to share those types of stories. So what I did was rather than put these stories on my main show, Nighttime, I worked with a local radio station, and I'm going to have a radio series that'll also be a web series. And it's going to be, again, called UFOs Above Canada. And it's going to look at the history of the UFO phenomenon in Canada, both from the point of view of the role our government played in it. It's going to cover the main Canadian UFO events, but a significant portion of it is going to be talking to everyday Canadians who've experienced something or seen something unusual in the sky they can't explain. So I'm going to be doing the things like going to the mall and sitting with a little sign in front of me that says, have you seen a UFO? If so, tell me about it. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I'm planning to do on the show.
Well, that ought to be interesting.
Yeah.
And by the way, give me a dollar too. You know, might as well ask for money at the same time. You know.
Yeah. Why not? Buy me a coat. This Canada. Buy me a coffee.
Yeah. Hey. So, you were telling me we talked earlier, and you were saying that you posted some newspaper ads and also somewhere out there on the web, and you got like 500 emails right away?
Yeah, pretty much. Like what I did was I, when, as I mentioned, like with UFOs above Canada, I really want to get kind of the, not so much, I'm not so much going for like the UFO researchers and ufologists and these sorts of people to get involved in the show. I wanted to get kind of the everyday Canadian type person who've seen something to share their story. So rather than spending my time plugging the show and what I'm doing on, you know, the main like UFO kind of networks and stuff that I communicate with people on, I put ads in, like, of course, Kijiji, local newspapers. I plugged it through my own podcast, Nighttime, of course, and basically just asking anybody who had experienced something or seen something to send me an email letting me know what you saw. And basically, I explained that, you know, I was hoping to include as many people as possible in this series. And I expected to get some emails, but the response I got was just completely overwhelming. I 500, maybe a bit of exaggeration, but I think in 2 weeks I definitely got over 300. But I have a whole pile of experiences to sort through. And what's interesting about these, it's everyday people recounting something they experienced in the 70s or 80s, and it's, some of it's strange, some of it's very kind of cliche UFO stories, but really, like, what I get out of seeing all these emails come through, reading where the people are from and reading their experience, is just how common it is to experience a UFO event in your life. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can think of the and I'm sure you've been down this road a million times, you can think of a UFO as an alien spaceship, but really, if you step away from that explanation and just think of it as, you know, a bizarre thing you saw in the sky, people are more willing to come out of the woodwork and, you know, and tell you about it. And yeah, it's anyway, I was surprised at the response, but at the same time, I'm not surprised, because, you know, everybody I knows somebody who saw something if they hadn't seen it themselves.
That's right. I love the stories myself that that are just by, I want to say people outside of the normal realm of listening to shows or being involved in shows. I love hearing those stories because they're so pure, and oftentimes they repeat exactly what you hear all the time, like
exactly.
The silent triangle or whatever it is. You know, it's great. I love those stories.
Yeah, and it just shows you how common it is. Like if like you yourself, Martin, you're very involved in the UFO phenomenon. You're talking about it with people every week, and, you know, and these are the things you follow on Facebook, and this is the news you read. So that's kind of your life. But when you take somebody who doesn't even know what a podcast is, or that there is UFO, you know, discussion happening on the internet, and you ask them about it, you get a much more pure, untainted look at the UFO phenomenon from the regular, you know, for a regular person. And that's kind of what, on my show, I'm kind of hoping that will come out, and I'll really be able to make a case for that.
What up in Canada? And by the way, that was a blast this last year, going all the way up to Shag Harbor. I'll never drive there again though.
But if you do, take care of your wallet better this time.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I'll get you. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, what does the person into UFOs in Canada think of Paul Hellyer?
Well, to be honest, I think the average Canadian doesn't know about him or know that, you know our government's connection to the UFO phenomenon. I think the people who do know about him and who are into UFOs, like myself, I'm kind of proud. Like, I think it's cool to have that high ranking of a government official being that open with their interest in the UFO phenomenon. And even beyond that, beyond having an interest, he's even spoke about how close he was to arranging, you know, contact between the Canadian government and, you know, blank extraterrestrial life forms. There was some talk of a landing happening within Canada that he was involved in. And he has even made some vague kind of, you can call them threats or just make them predictions, but he thinks that a major UFO event is going to happen, I think, before 2020 is what he said. But I think the average person, if you walk through the mall today and asked the average Canadian if they know about Paul Hellyer, they would have no idea. I'm sure of it.
Okay. So what are some of the interesting cases? Now, last time you were on, I believe, prior to me running up to Sag Harbor, we talked about the guy that is the raccoon whisperer, right?
Yeah, that's the Clarenville, Newfoundland event. That was a police officer who saw something bizarre in Clarenville, Newfoundland, and he even looked at it through his police surveillance equipment. And we did the episode about him together on my show with Alejandro as well. And now he's no longer researching UFOs. Instead, he lives in the middle of the woods and feeds raccoons out of his living room.
Yeah, there's YouTube videos of them. They come in like a big swarm of them.
He feeds them hot dogs. It's kind of terrifying, but I guess that's what he likes. I don't know what that does for his credibility. Because I was trying to explain to people how reputable it was that, you know, a police officer had experienced this and wrote the reports, and there was all these witnesses. That sounds really great, but then when you get to the point that he now lives among raccoons, you're kind of like, ah.
It changed his life. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's a very honest guy, and that's a great story. But that's although you know that story, we spoke about it, that's not one of the major Canadian UFO events. Really, in Canada, there's two or three main events, and when it comes to the UFO phenomenon, two of them occurred in 1967 within months of each other. One was the Sag Harbor event, or the Sag Harbor incident, which was in Nova Scotia, where I'm living, and that was basically a UFO event seen by a whole community. It was investigated by government. There was dives teams sent out into the water, and you know, that was people call it Canada's Roswell just because of the amount of attention it got from government investigators, civilian investigators, and just managed to capture the attention of everyday Canadians and, you know, the media and whatnot. There's a whole bunch of cool newspaper articles from that time. So that was in 67. And the other big one, really, in 67, the opposite side of the country is the Falcon Lake incident, yeah, which happened in Manitoba. I'm sure you've heard about that one.
Oh, yeah. The grill marks. That was that's a fairly solid case. Wouldn't you consider that?
Definitely, and it's left some trace evidence as well. Chris Rutkowski, who we call the Canadian UFO guy, I don't know if you've ever had him on your show.
Yeah.
Chris actually, he's kind of the face of that, investigating that event. But he had a piece of metal that was obtained from the scene that was that has been tested. It's now, I think, sealed behind glass, but it was tested in, I don't know a lot about this stuff. This is probably like a question for like Stanton Friedman, but the radioactive signature of the metal is unlike any other radioactive signature that would be associated with metals. I don't know what that means, but I do know that it made a very unique artifact left behind from the sighting. But you know, that's Falcon Lake. It's a very believable story. Much like Sag Harbor, the witness doesn't seem to have any connection with the UFO phenomenon or any reason to make something up or lie. He also received injuries. You mentioned the grill marks. The witness of the Falcon Lake event got close enough to a UFO or some type of object. The exhaust that came out of a grill left a really bizarre burn on his body. And you know, there's pictures all over the internet. If you search Falcon Lake, you'll see him laying in a hospital bed like that. But what's cool about Falcon Lake, you may have seen this going around the UFO news, is just recently the Canadian Mint released a coin commemorating it.
Yeah.
Did you see this?
I did, yeah.
So the coin is the shape of an alien head, and it has a picture of like the guy, Stan Mikulak, laying on his back with the UFO kind of hovering above him. But what's cool about the coin is it's glow in the dark. So when it's in the dark, it's a different version of the picture that glows. It's beautiful.
Wow. It's also like $140 or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think it was 140 Canadian, which is, I think, about $15 American, the way the exchange works now. But no, that's exaggerating. But yeah. It's there were, I think it was only like 3,000 of them made, and they yeah, there were about 130. The face value of it's $20, but they sold out immediately, and I think they're already on eBay for a couple $100 more than they sold for. So it's you know, I don't know much about coin collection. I guess that's kind of up your alley a little bit, but I know the
not for contemporary, but
okay.
So now, what about this piece of metal you just spoke about? Had that, besides radioactivity, did they do like an analysis of the metals and alloy or whatever it is?
There's been a lot of testing done of it, but the thing is, and it's I don't know if this is uncommon or if this is common for a lot of UFO events, is basically every detail of the tests has been disputed by kind of competing factions. The one community who believes every test or every, you know, scientist involved in it are, you know, crooked and doing things wrong. Uh-oh. So it's hard to kind of to swim through the swamp that surrounds the investigation into that. Chris Rutkowski would be the guy to explain it. I don't know the science well enough, but I do know that all the tests of it, what has been released basically shows that it's anomalous in every way. But as a being a skeptic and being skeptical myself, I feel like if it was that anomalous, you know, the government would have taken it and, you know, have figured it out. So I kind of have a question mark around that.
So this piece of metal, did it just fall off the craft or what? I mean,
it was found in the site of where the UFO event occurred. Basically, the witness to the Falcon Lake sighting, he was interested in, he was like into geology. So he would go on these long walks and basically look for odd rocks and such. And he was basically in the middle of nowhere in this area called Falcon Lake and witnessed a craft basically land. He thought it was an experimental, like kind of like maybe like an experimental aircraft or something. So he approached it and was saying like, is everybody okay in there? Like, what's going on? And he spoke several languages. So he's going through different languages, asking if people are okay. He didn't see anybody, but he did see like a grill of kind of a whole bunch of little holes on the side. So when he kind of approached that grill, that was when the object lifted up and an exhaust came out of that grill and left the pattern burn mark. He eventually made it back to safety and was in the hospital to be treated and whatnot. And in the days, weeks, months, and now years after that, people have gone in and around that area looking for evidence that may have been left behind. In the days immediately after it, there was a clearing found where the event had occurred, and that's where the piece of metal was found.
Oh, I see. Now, what about radioactive burns? Is that what he actually had? Did they ever figure out what he had?
Yeah, it was some type of burn from radiation.
It really was. Wow.
Yeah, and it's, if you look at it, it's like the look on his chest from the photos from back then. They're a high resolution photo, so you get a really good look. It's a very clear pattern. It almost looks like he was branded by, you know, a hot a grid of circles basically across his lower chest.
Now, I may be confusing this with upper United States, but there was a really amazing sighting that was seen around a major lake or something by a lot of people, very, very large craft. Is that, does that ring any bells to you?
No, that wouldn't be Falcon Lakes. Falcon Lakes.
No, I'm not talking about Falcon. I'm talking about another sighting.
No, that doesn't. It's I'm not sure what you'd be thinking of with that.
Yeah, that might have been, that could have been like either Michigan or someplace like that, possibly. What about some other noted sightings that you can talk about?
Well, there's Canada has one that I really enjoyed. I think I may have told you about this when we met in person. This is Kensington PEI. So PEI is Prince Edward Island. It's a island near Nova Scotia, not too far from Shag Harbor.
Right.
It was in 2014, and this is one that this event is one you and Alejandro would love, because the news, the media really grabbed onto this, and there was basically a battle fought in the media between MUFON investigators and a whole bunch of people from different disciplines who were criticizing the MUFON investigation. Basically, what it was a guy, he was on a campground in Kensington PEI, and the campground overlooked the Bay of Fundy, I believe it was, like a large body of water. This area, there wouldn't be plane traffic, helicopters, there's no major city there. So at night, it's pitch black. It was him and his wife had a bonfire. She went to bed, and he kind of sat up until, you know, the embers put themselves out, basically. And while he was sitting there, the way he described it, he was just kind of on his phone flipping through the news and whatnot, and saw a weird light in the sky as he was doing this. So he just kind of looked at it, being like, you know, he had explained to me that he had gone camping here basically every year since he was a child, and he's now, you know, in his 40s. So he's used to the skies there, and he thought, like, that's weird. I've never really seen a bright light floating in the skies around here. And so he watched it. Eventually, it was moving erratically, so he started filming it on his iPhone or whatever. And he filmed it, and as he's filming it, he's kind of narrating what he's seeing. And he watched it for maybe a half hour as the thing just kind of danced around the sky, getting brighter, getting darker, lower, higher, didn't really seem to have any specific pattern. Eventually, the light just basically dissolved into nothing, and, you know, it just disappeared. But he was sure it was something unique. The next morning, he saw some what appeared to be military helicopters in the area, which was also bizarre. So he thought, and also at a place. So he started Googling, how do you report a UFO sighting? Because that's what he believed it to be. He stumbled upon MUFON's website and filled out whatever you fill out to report it. And he sent them their videos and his videos, and didn't think anything of it until the way he explained it to me, it was about 8 months later. He heard from MUFON, who explained that they had sent an investigator and they weren't able to come up with an explanation, so they ruled it an unexplained, you know, sighting. Then CBC, which is our national media, they did a story basically saying, you know, this civilian or this UFO investigation group investigated a sighting and deemed it a certified UFO that couldn't be explained. They posted his video and a brief explanation, but then it was 2 days later, maybe, a follow-up article where they were quoting, you know, an astronomer says it's this, and a, you know, some expert on drones said it was a drone, and they had all these different people that were kind of debunking it, and it led to this back and forth. But it led to a lot of really cool news articles. Wow. The video itself that he took is a little unremarkable, because of course if you're filming a bright light in the sky at night, it's, you know, it's a black screen with a little dot. But his narration serves as a very cool firsthand account, especially given the fact that he's giving the narration as he's filming it. But
yeah, let's hear some of the sightings that people have written to you. Do you have any of those available?
Oh yeah, I have a whole slew of them. I have even before I began collecting stories for UFOs Above Canada, since I cover the UFO phenomenon so much on my podcast Nighttime, I'll get people writing to me just sharing their story and seeing if I'm interested. But now in the last probably 2 weeks, when I open my email, I just have a slew of these. So what I'll do is, to make it interesting, I'm not vetting these. I'm just going to go at random and kind of grab a few and read them to you.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes just to let you know.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. There's a lot. I'll go with some shorter ones.
All right, sure.
This first one is from a Jeff Dick. This sighting occurred in 1975 in Victoria, BC. Nice and short. He says, on my way home from work at about 1 a.m., I spotted seven orange glowing orbs that appeared to be dancing in the sky for about 10 minutes. For that period of time, I spotted them at about 20 degrees low on the horizon. So short and sweet, so not much, uh-huh. Not much there. Here's a bit longer of one. Oh, it's actually the same guy. My wife and I were heading to Winnipeg when up in the clouds, we saw a large red glow. The object descended from the clouds and was visible as a long bar, maybe 200 feet long. It was completely lit in bright red light. As we traveled along, the object cast a red glow around us like a floodlight and followed us for about 10 kilometers. I kept driving as I didn't want to stop and risk the consequences. Suddenly, the light surrounding us stopped and the craft ascended back above the clouds and out of sight.
Hmm.
And that's it.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that story. That reminds me of when I was on your show in the past, I talked about this, but my introduction to the UFO phenomenon is when I was a kid, my grandmother and grandfather claimed to have had a very similar experience with basically a large light hovering above their car, eventually to just dissolve and fly away. It reminds me of this, although this sighting is from the opposite side of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Let's grab another one here. Let's see. Here's a bit longer. So this one is from a Duncan Chisholm, summer 2004 in western Newfoundland. So not a great deal from where you are. It says, at about 11 p.m., I was finishing a campfire in my backyard and getting ready to go to bed, and I saw this set of lights move halfway across the sky. It was a triangle shape with four lights, each tip of the triangle in one dead center. The lights changed color from red to yellow to bright white. The white was so bright it almost looked blue. It stopped dead center over my town and moved with very short, precise zigzags across the sky. I watched as the craft lowered closer to Earth, and within one final glint, it shot through a cloud and cut a perfectly straight, uniform light through it. And then he says, I never spoke much about it, as these people who I brought it up to thought I was crazy or after dipping into the moonshine. I only realized exactly what it was after seeing some very similar footage many years later, as well as hearing similar testimony online.
Oh, that's kind good. Of it. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a common thread is people will say, I didn't think anything of it until years later when I, you know, read this or watched this. So I think one thing about like folks like you covering the UFO phenomenon is it kind of it's almost like therapeutic for the people who once upon a time had experienced something unusual, because it just takes hearing other people talking about it and, you know, making it all a bit more grounded that people will come out. So I think a part of the reason I got such a response to people emailing me is they're realizing in my blurb, I talked about how common a UFO event is, and it's not something just for, you know, Star Trek fans to have experience. So I think maybe that set people at ease and encourage them to come out with some stories.
I know I spoke with Greg Bishop, I think it was maybe 3 weeks ago, and he was talking about, you know, being at or meeting people and talking to them. And he says sometimes people just unload a story on him and they feel better and walk away. You know, it's like it is like a therapy almost you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about it, and when they finally feel comfortable talking about it, it is like a type of therapy.
Yeah, I was at a this is 3 weeks ago maybe. I was at a function related to my profession, my day job or my profession, and it was kind of like a team building type thing. There was maybe 50 people there or something, and the way the activity worked is before we went to the event, we all had to write a fact about ourselves, and then when you show up at the event, you get a sheet and there's a fact about every person, like an interesting fact. And the goal was you would spend the day kind of meeting everybody, and then by the end of the day be able to fill in or have figured out who's what interesting fact goes with which person. So for example, one of them was like, you know, I was a extra on the Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie, let's say. So as you're meeting people, you could ask, you know, is that you? And it give you something to talk about. Just as to make it interesting, I put my interesting fact was that I spend a lot of time researching and reading about and being involved in the UFO phenomenon, because I knew it would create some interesting conversation. But what I learned was, I thought people would, I'm thinking, you know, people may think I'm a little nuts because, you know, my professional life doesn't bring me in touch with a lot of people that I would think are into the paranormal. But anyway, to my surprise, I think everybody I talked to who asked, like, are you the guy with the UFO one? And I was like, yeah. Then they would then recount their UFO story.
Yeah,
I saw one in the 70s, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not a strange thing. It's just people, I think what happened is movies and TV has made the UFO, that word or whatever you want to call it, has made that associated with this fringe alien spaceship thing. But really, that's not what it is. And it's, you know, it just needs to be normalized. And I think, like, what's going on in the States with the recently they come out with, you know, that's the secret
Pentagon
aerial threat. Yeah, that whole thing. It's things like that just serve to make it a bit more reasonable for people to talk about. So I think, you know, that's great.
Yeah. All right, Jordan. Well, thank you so much. Why don't you give out your podcast website, if you would?
Yeah, best way to find me is my website is nighttimepodcast.com, or you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at nighttimepod. And Martin, I hope to have you on the show as soon as I launch it this summer.
Excellent. All right, Jordan. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Talk to you soon. All right. So our next guest is she's in Europe, so she's been staying up really late. And so she going to be calling her right now, so just hang in there. And here we go. So about her, she used to be a lawyer, and she was specializing in gender equality, human rights. And now she writes fiction. She collects typewriters, and she is sideways.
Oh, my God.
Martin. All right, hang on. We'll get you adjusted.
There you go.
There you are. You're right side
up
now.
Wasn't I sideways when we tried? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Hi, Martin.
All right, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Good.
Looking forward to it.
And what time is it where you are?
It is, almost 3 a.m.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. How's the coffee going? Drink a little bit of coffee? Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah. So you have this book, interesting book, and it's your first book. And not only that, it is a very thick book. Wow, lots of pages. I saw 100,000 words or something like that. Amazing.
Yeah. A lot of stories and UFO related stories as well.
Right. Can you just go ahead and give like a synopsis of the book? You know, just basically it's in the future, and there's trouble, which there always seems to be in the future, right?
Yeah. So basically, in the future, humanity has this gift, this potential to access reality through consciousness, and the basis of this idea is in quantum theories, quantum consciousness theories, and humans are basically like a planet scale experiment of an alien race who is trying to just crack the code. How the hell is this mediocre at best race of, you know, beings has this potential for this ability to access the fabric of the universe through consciousness? And so they undertaken this giant experiment. They reverse engineered our race on Earth, created perfect lab conditions, and their government also is in turmoil, and there is the debate whether to destroy us before we fully became capable to use this oscillation ability, and which would mean that's like an ultimate weapon. You know, they are not prepared to fight consciousness, you know, fight reality that is malleable. And so basically, our human danger lies in what different government fractions of the aliens decide on our behalf. And meanwhile, here and there, individuals pop up who actually are very close to oscillate. So this is the broad premise of the story.
So what inspired you to write this?
It was not one single event, but what became a push to actually write down the story was me living in Liberia. And so basically this is where kind of my story begins, on in Africa, on Liberian coast, in the future, some few hundred years in the future, when humanity lived through environmental crisis related to global warming, and we tried to fix it, we botched it entirely. And so, long story short, this tropical belt of Earth became some of the only habitable areas in the world. So living in Liberia and experiencing poverty that is not the fault of Liberians. This is an extremely rich country who is being, that is being exploited since its conception. And if you know anything about Liberian history, it's the country where freed slaves of the United States were repatriated. And basically living there and just being confronted with the desperate situation of this country, I kind of came up with this premise to fix these wrongs, in, at least in my story. So this, the center of the civilization on Earth became the Central Africa, Western Africa.
According to what I've read a little bit, bits and pieces of your book, that so basically what happens in your book is that the reversing of the global warming kind of went haywire and everything freezes, yeah. But all of a sudden the prime real estate is places like Libya, right? Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. And that's one of the sort of ideas why I decided to how I started to write the book. There is no single event that pushed me to write this book, except I've been writing fiction for some time. This is the one that ended up being published first. I wanted to write a story, and this one became a combination. It's my attempt to try to make sense of so many mysteries in the world and so many science themes that and history that I'm fascinated with. So it's kind of like a multifaceted story.
Uh-huh. And you've looked into things like the Battle of L.A. and things like that. You've looked into these things.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the facets of the story is because, of course, in my universe, the alien presence is, we have alien presence on Earth and very active alien presence. So basically, from that premise, I started to untangling this sort of ball of yarn, and it became an exercise in what if. So I would take a piece of history, like, for example, the known UFO sightings or some historic events, and sort of put it into perspective of this alien race doing the experiment on Earth. And so it became the what if game. Like, for example, what if aliens are really watching us? Where would they be? And so a lot of I call it a mythology, but it's like more like sightings. There's a lot of claim that aliens might be hiding either submerged somewhere in the ocean, because we don't go there all that much. We know about the ocean floor even less than we know about the surrounding space, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So there was like one piece of what if puzzle. Then I took a few UFO sightings, like, let's say the oldest one that I worked with is in 1982, for example. There was this classic triangle UFO sighting over the moon in Lebanon, Connecticut. And two brothers, astronomers, they noticed these triangle UFOs over the disk of the moon, and they made a record of it. And in what happened in Los Angeles was particularly fascinating. So basically, again, this was an exercise in what if. What if aliens are here and we have this, and I got a glimpse of these, your previous speaker, like, really, there is this overwhelming consensus of the sightings. There are several categories, but there is a lot of information that can be categorized very nicely. It's either triangle-shaped objects or, you know, there's certain patterns. Why? So I was thinking, what would the aliens be doing on Earth? What are they doing while... you know, we observe them, sort of. And in my story, I connected to the sightings where, like, mass healings occur. Like, for example, one of the big miracles in Portugal in 1917 that occurred. And not to offend anybody's religious beliefs, I don't know, but this is a big Catholic, like, holy place, Our Lady Fatima. Right. In 1917, a big apparition of Lady Mary and mass healing. And when I read about that story, even how the Mary is described, she described as more of like a, well, I saw it as a holographic image, like a holographic projection. Mouth didn't move. So I put that into context of aliens performing healing, mass healing operations on their test subjects, because the ability to oscillate comes with a whole bunch of like diseases, like cancers, various autoimmune deficiencies, and so basically to keep their experiment going, they need to keep those viable samples alive long enough to procreate. So that explains all the sightings that we experience. You can group them however you want, but this becomes the premise of my story. And so I describe the sightings of 1942 in Los Angeles, which that one completely captivates my imagination, because every time a big military response is involved, I'm thinking to myself, there's a lot of military generals, smart people who see a lot of stuff. They know how to identify an airplane or, you know, anything, you know. And in 1942, what happened, a lot of ammunition was discharged in the sky, and even there were casualties from the debris. Mm-hmm. So that clearly says to me, okay, there is a big smoking gun there in that story. And the way the UFOs, let's call them UFOs, were described by eyewitnesses, the military people, the way they showed up on the radars, that did not fit into the pattern of any known flying object of the American power or any other power, for that matter, known to humanity. So the same pattern repeated about 10 years later in Washington, D.C., and it was, again, a mass sighting over a course of several weeks, actually. And I read somewhere on the internet, I don't know how verified that is, but even some say that John McCain was one of the people who, back in the day, witnessed that. That I don't know if that is verified, but, like, I just found that a little bit of fascinating piece of information. Would be cool to ask him someday. Yeah. If that's true or not, but anyhow, the same pattern, the dispatched aircraft, Air Force involved, several aircrafts are trying to intercept these flying objects, and they just make a fool out of everybody, and yet they are clearly caught on the radars. You know, on land, on the radars, on the tarmac of the airplanes, in the sky on the radar. So, like, when there is such a multiple level of verification of the event, you can't quite easily just boot it out to the weather balloons or whatever, whatnot.
Yeah, the one in L.A. didn't that the craft or crafts just like hover? They were just stationary, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really bizarre.
Well, The bizarre part about the case was, and you need to remember the context. 1942, that's the World War II, and the tensions with the Japanese. So there was like high military alert, and these objects were hovering over the ammunition factory at first, and they moved downtown. So there was. You know, they were in strategic locations. And again, when we read ufology accounts, we often kind of trace sightings to like either nuclear sites or classified sites for whatever reason. It seems like the UFOs have particular interest to the fact that we are capable of destroying ourselves, because obviously we don't pose any threat to any other race that made its way over here.
Not yet, but yeah, we pose more of a threat to ourselves. That's
exactly,
for sure.
Yeah. So
that the one in the 1952, that's fascinating, that they were outrun, and you know, they kept trying to go after them and all that. Earlier you mentioned, I know it's part of your book, but the oscillating, what is that? Is that something you just thought up, or is there any type of science behind that?
The theory that is I'm basing my science premise is by the British phenomenal scientist Roger Penrose, and he's just as bit of a brilliant mathematician and physicist, and he is like royally recognized by the highest awards. And but less, when I bring up his name, people who just don't read a lot deeper in science, they know Stephen Hawking, for example, but they know less of Roger Penrose. But Roger Penrose is a very interesting scientist, because he was forced in his research to confront the connection of human consciousness as a sort of a quantum computer, to not think of it as kind of a, like a binary type of machine, but as a quantum computer, that our consciousness, in his calculations and observations and whatnot, seems to appear on quantum level. And he reluctantly, multiple times, because you know, scientists don't like to sound like, because that doesn't sound too scientific. You know, when we talk about subatomic particles and their weird behavior, okay, that's been like for 100 years around. We kind of grew to accept weird, spooky actions at a distance with the subatomic particles. But what Roger Penrose is saying, that our consciousness is like something entirely else. It's not a sum of our brain cells. It's something more than that. And the way it operates on that quantum level. So it's like if you think of like a computer code or like a program, a programmed environment, which is kind of our universe, is, you know, there's data, there's rules and laws of how it operates. So you can think of it as a code. So our consciousness seems to have like backdoor, you know, like backdoors to crack the code, what he seems to say. And basically he cites amazing research done by biologists for example, he also says, he brought up the example of baseball players. So based on the speed of the ball and the reaction, and we know how fast our eye reacts, how fast our muscle reacts. So, you know, scientists are notorious for that type of meticulous calculation. So you plug it on into equation, and the reaction of a baseball player who connects the bat with the ball at that speed does not compute with our physical ability to do that. So processes faster than our physical ability to you know, to process information are happening. And so oscillation, this is a term borrowed from quantum physics, and so I put it into the science premise of my book, giving the humanity this potential to more actively use consciousness as a key to the reality.
Is it something like sense? Something separate than physical, like as far as like the travel? I've heard other people say, you know, that you know, there's that the consciousness can travel, you know, I mean, just as a theory. So is this like separate? Are they separate than the beings in your book, the consciousness? Oops, we may have lost her. That's possible. She's gone. We will try her again. Hang on. Live listener, hang on. We will try her back. There you are. You're back.
Hey, I'm back. There we go.
Not sure what happened. There you are.
Yeah, I have okay. No idea. Basically, the way you think about reality on subatomic level is probabilities. So if you heard the premise from quantum physics, so whatever is possible, it is probable it might happen in some other parallel.
Oh, she is skipping out again. Let's try her. All right. Hang on. I will try her again. Hang on, everyone. Thank you for hanging in. And let's see. All right. So, looks like she's back.
Hello.
There you are. Okay, your camera's off, I think, but you're on.
Hello?
Your audio's on. Can you hear us over here? There you are.
Hi. I back?
You are back, yeah. Is your
That's fantastic.
Your internet going okay over there?
It seems to be fine.
Okay.
So I looked over at my laptop. It seems to be connected. I'm sorry. My apologies. So let me just try to bring the thought to the conclusion in the least amount of sentences. On subatomic level, everything exists in probabilities. And if our consciousness has access to those probabilities of the events occurring, basically, there is a potential for humans to sort of access those probabilities. And you know, it's like a toss of a coin. You know, if we could access a quantum state where both coin is in both states simultaneously, and we could just flip a coin to the way we wanted, just multiply that effect to, like, for example, let's say I want a sandwich to appear before me. This is a really
That's convenient.
Weird yeah. example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if imagine if you go and I use that example in my book where people are able to like gamble and predict the dice or roulette, you know, because you access. I mean, it's probabilities. There's a probability of certain number or color on the roulette to pop up, or you know, and if you access the quantum pool of these probabilities and you can interact with that, you potentially can sort of gain information from those quantum states which when event either will occur or to even influence the certain event to occur a certain way, like disasters like a car crash. You know, if you have access to the probabilities, so it's kind of a binary situation, either car crashes or not crashes, you know. So when you react I can't explain you any further than that because I am writing book two, and if I say one more word than that, it's just gonna, you know, give away too much of the explanation of my universe. But basically, in the science premise of my book, it's kind of a very existential search. What are we are? What, you know, who we are, in a sense.
So
trying to make sense of the fabric of the universe a little bit.
Yeah. Have you always had this type of thinking going through life? I mean, what kind of, like, got you interested in this type of thinking?
I kind of been wired a little bit into science by my high school experience, because I was in advanced physics mathematics class, at which I was like lower third of the students, because everybody else was so bloody good. But you know, just when you're spending so much time trying to you know, understand science, when at school it was sort of a burden, you know, and my artistic nature wanted to write poems and stories and fiction. And back in the day, even I wrote a little bit of a science fiction, tried. When you leave school and when you don't have to, when it's not an obligation anymore, I rediscovered Einstein's theories, and just, I can't even pinpoint, it happened about 10 years ago when I rediscovered and fell in love in physics all over again in a much more enjoyable way, because I started to see the big picture. It's not anymore about the equations and trigonometry and any of that. It's about me. Who am I, and what am I doing in this universe? And the quantum physics totally blows my mind. And from then on, yeah, I've been trying to keep up with the science side of, you know, the discovery of the gravitational waves, and, you know, recent discoveries, and just astronomy and water on Mars and whatnot. You know, I'm just trying to keep up with that, because that's absolutely fascinating to me.
So in your book, is it, I'm always curious about the ending. Was it a good ending, or is it a bad ending? Can you give us a little... Or can you give us a little overall details of how it goes?
Yeah. So book has two parts, which are kind of separate. They are divided by 300 years in my timeline. And I begin part one from heavy historic... I submerge the reader in our known history through this fictional lens, which my hope was that by the time that the reader is done with the part one of the book, when I go about, like I talk about the Cold War, the Japanese Tokugawa Shogunate period, the isolation, I talk about the Soviets and the Cubans and JFK and the Voynich manuscript, which, you know, my story has to do with Leonardo da Vinci a little bit. So I pull on so much history and UFO events. So it's kind of like each chapter is a story of itself that it connects. So you can read it as, like, as a TV series, like, let's call it a Black Mirror type of thing, you know. But they are connected. They are connected. And by the time you're done with this part one of the book, my hope was that the reader will get this feeling that, hey, this actually might be somehow or to a degree or somehow real, because the pieces of the puzzle fit. You know, we start seeing the motives, why aliens are here, why they could be here, what is their agenda, okay, what is their culture, how would they be operating on Earth? So they are basically doing this research, and they have their own bureaucracy, and as in any bureaucracy, there is these tensions between different sort of bureaus, let's call it that way. So it's a big research. It takes a lot of resources from the aliens. So some of their inner, in which way kind of it's a little bit an allegory of our bipartisan culture, what it seems to be in the earth. Like whatever country you take, there is a bipartisan tribal type of thinking is happening, and so that's a little bit an allegory, a joke on us, on humans, through these aliens. And so the part two of the book just takes off very differently. It's more of like not a Black Mirror type of thing anymore. It's more like a think of a film that starts from a bang and finishes with even bigger bang. Happens 300 in 2500s, and the humanity is already aware of the alien presence. There was big reveal, and there is basically a Cold War situation between aliens and humans because nobody is telling the truth. Aliens reveal themselves, but they cannot exactly quite say that, well, we've been messing with you and we've been like engineering all sorts of disasters and famines and biological, we try to exterminate and breed you however we see fit because we just were doing this genetic experiment, which the only way we found out to be feasible is to let you people live your lives, sort of think that you're living your lives, because consciousness is a tricky thing. You can't quite do consciousness experiments in the lab so much, so humans needed to have that experience of developing their consciousness in generations and, growing into the ability to connect into the universe through, some say through meditation, through prayer, some say it's, so when basically you become more aware of your being and your existing in this universe, and that produces this oscillation effect. And so basically in the part two of the book, it's a full-on Cold War with the aliens. It takes place on different planets because humans are already more technologically advanced. And so there is a big tension, like one alien faction wants to destroy us. It's like this experiment went too far. Look, they got to our space now, And another one, and I can't quite reveal because this is going to be a punchline for the title of the book. But there is two soldiers, the only two survivors in the alien space. The whole big mission was sent to find information on the strategic positions and weapons and some of the aliens and their plans about destroying us, actually closing the research. And that mission was failed, and the only two soldiers are now being tortured and interrogated by the aliens. And by the end of the book, something happens that brings aliens and these two soldiers to realize that in a certain predicament that this Cold War of humans and aliens created, they need to be looking for a common ground in the face of even a bigger threat. Let's put it that way.
Well, interesting. We have a couple of questions that came up in chat. Sure. And also, if you'd be willing, I can also open the lines if someone would like to call in and ask you a question.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead. First of all, someone wanted to know, have you yourself ever had any type of UFO sighting?
No, personally not. No.
Have you looked for one?
No, I haven't, but I trust people like Buzz Aldrin and all the generals and the Canadian generals and whatnot. They are way closer to the truth. And like with the previous guests on the show, you mentioned about this budget spending on the alien threat identification type of thing. Follow the money.
Yeah.
Follow the money, So I do trust those facts, those types of data, and we wouldn't be having even protocols for dealing with the UFOs in the military if, you know, if we didn't need them. Military people are not fans of the X-Files, let's put it that way. Or, I don't know, maybe they are, but, you know, I just trust that they have better things to do than make up fiction.
Right. Where the country that you're in right now, do you happen to know how the UFO phenomena is treated? You know, how is it respected, or is it fringe? Like,
no, you know, I think anywhere you go in the world right now, it's thanks to Hollywood in part, but I think our psyche is prepared in a sense. Like, for example, I've been talking to some people who can relate to me on the UFO level a lot faster than they on the religion or ethnicity or like or some kind of social level. I think if we did a decent poll, like huge number of people are believers.
Yeah.
Well, I'm personally a firm believer that there's like way too much smoking gun in this story. I'm just not the holder of the classified files to know.
I've said a number of times on this show that I think there's definitely something going on. I mean, I saw something with my own eyes, and I trust a lot of people have seen things with their own eyes. But what it is, the problem.
I've definitely seen things in the sky, but I'm not just jumping, you know, I don't want to portray myself as a such an avid UFO seeker that I see like any old thing in the sky and claim it to be a UFO. That's just, you know, I have too much of a respect for science and research to do that. But
yeah,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. Just sometimes when you know, I mean, what I saw was unexplainable. And a lot of people I know have seen things that are unexplainable. And, you know, we've talked on the show where some sightings people brush off as something, you know, military experiment aircraft. But then those very same sightings were seen, you know, 50 years ago, exactly the same type of situation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's actually possible. We will take calls if anyone would like to call in. That number's up on the screen right now. So you're welcome to call in if you'd like.
And I would like to say, while we were waiting for the call, even like, let's take a look in the broad human history. This is what I did in the book to a large degree. If I could,
sure.
You know, you already said it's a pretty large book, you know, so I had to pick and choose historic pieces that would go into my puzzle, sort of. But if you think about the history of humanity, like the pyramids, like that alone, the existence of pyramids in Egypt and in South America, just things like this, and apparitions like Our Lady Fatima. I'm not against religious beliefs, but if you read that one with a modern framework, if you read those accounts with a modern framework, you will see that something is much less divinely mysterious is happening. Because, you know, people, like, I'm a huge fan of this Stargate franchise. So, you know, I think their way of weaving mythology, for example, into the narrative of the aliens is quite brilliant, which is kind of relevant to the discussion, for example. So what we used to think of being gods of various natures, you know, might very well be visitors from who knows where, or some ancestors, maybe humans of some type, maybe aliens, I don't know. Possibilities are endless.
Right. A question that came up, what was the the motivation idea behind the different alien factions? Seems very realistic, according to this person. And so they just want to know what your thoughts were on that.
I'm kind of a little bit of a politics buff as well. I think I watch too much politics and political comedy as well. So, you know, when you get like so wired to sort of like observe, and as a person who worked in government and just like knows bureaucracy for what it is, and how sometimes, you know, like big things that appear big and very thought out and like a policy on the surface sometimes could be just like a random thing like some random clerk, nameless clerk, may have like just a like a signature type of authority to will things to be like the earmarking things to the budget, for example, and things like that. So just when you start thinking about bureaucracies and just sociology, you know, how beings exist, even in the animal kingdom, I mean, there's tribes, there is always the adversarial principle in everything. So when you think about that and you extrapolate, okay, if there are aliens, of course there's a train of thought that they will be so evolved that they will have no conflict. And I personally don't buy that.
Well, I'm on the fence myself about that now that you mention it, because it's like we really don't know. You know, we really don't know the nature
of... We don't. That's true.
A lot of the aggression and stuff that we have as a species is all evolutionary to, you know, survival instincts and all that. That's why we're tribal. But we don't know how another species would evolve on another planet. You know, we have no idea.
Yeah, but if we say that we are life and they are life, just in general, life. And life is like a, you know, it's a self-perpetuating circle of destruction. Something has to die for something to be born. That's, you know, just a philosophical principle. And like, I agree with you, it could be either way. Like, for all we know, aliens could be a non-corporeal energy type of species, multidimensional type of, you know, which if the consciousness thing is really has something to do with, if it's a real thing and if it's a type of energy, maybe we can be separated from our bodies. Maybe aliens can as well. Maybe they are. I don't know. Like in my book, I just picked one of those that seemed to be the most, the one possibility that I probably understand the most from the where I stand from human perspective.
Mm-hmm. A question that came up that says, I don't know, did I ask you? I may have asked you this question. I'm sorry if I did. But it says, you're fascinated by science and physics, but do you believe in the metaphysical UFOs and spiritual phenomena?
Okay, let's unpack that one. Metaphysical UFOs, as if like ghosts?
Yeah.
You know, I do. Here's where I firmly believe, and it kind of shows in the book. I do believe that there's human experiences are very vast and very different. And I sort of like come from the point of view where I don't necessarily want to disbelieve a person. You know, I come from, you know, unless there is some kind of like a social media Kardashian type of gain, you know, to be gained from public attention to something. Generally, people who speak up about UFOs, for example, let's pick UFOs, or ghosts or supernatural phenomena, they risk with being ridiculed, being, you know, lose some kind of social standing and like, you know what I mean? That's not generally where people want to be necessarily, ordinary people. Like, for example, if an alien walked into the room right now and nobody saw that, I would think hard, you know, should I bring that up? You know, I'm a writer, I can be weird, that's allowable, but to what degree, you know? So I do believe people's experiences, like the fact that I have not personally seen or experienced something doesn't mean that somebody else did not, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Have you followed up? I know you followed a lot of the UFO stories, but have you followed the abduction or experiencers or any of that? Have you looked into any of that when you were doing your research?
Yeah, some of my friends, shout out to the Instagram folks, we spoke about that. Some of them claim to have abduction experiences, and I'm not in the place of saying I don't believe your experience. You know, why would I do that? I know that generally when people bring that up, it's very traumatic.
Yeah.
Rarely you get what it seems to me from my unquantifiable subjective perspective when I read about that, that there is a lot more unpleasant traumatic experiences in those accounts than I've been enlightened or I've received some information or knowledge. I tend to be more distrustful of those types of claims, like prophet type of things. But I don't know why. Maybe that's bias. I do have biases, I suppose, like everybody.
Well, it's a I was on the fence a lot about abductions, and there was a couple of ones that were just so credible. Like I think Travis Walton. I'm not sure if you've followed the Travis Walton case.
No, I haven't. But
there are a few situations that are just, you know, with witnesses and are just quite amazing. So I also, you know, there was a couple things you mentioned way early on. You mentioned, you know, where are they hiding? Are they under the ocean? Mm-hmm. I do have someone coming up that's going to be talking about USOs. The curious part that I've always thought about on UFO sightings is the ones that are repeated over and over again. Why? Why would this particular thing show up in the same area over and over again instead of being exploring other parts of the planet or whatever? Why is it like right at this certain area? And there are many, many cases where a UFO just keeps showing up in the same space. It's pretty puzzling. The whole thing is puzzling.
Yeah,
but that is.
The whole thing is absolutely puzzling. And I think this is how my book came to be. From there's like a whole bunch of puzzles and you throw them into this box right here. You shake it up and you come up with, you try to connect the dots. You try to make sense out of it. And so in my book, I kind of, it's a hypothesis, if you will. You know, it's a exercise in what ifs. So if you think of them doing a certain type of a research or a project, showing up to a certain population or a research area that is monitored, just makes hell of a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what about the story goes to your book. I believe you're saying that you talk about like history. I heard you say JFK. I saw that in your blurb. So is this kind of like you're creating a case toward the future of what actually, where the direction it's going in? And do these things all kind of come together in the second part of the book?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And so basically from what I get from the readers, they say it's an experience of the Cloud Atlas or something like this that has like a lot of parts that seem to, you're not sure how they connect. Because, I mean, this is the world that we live in. Like, think about, like, MUFON and all the ufologists, like, and the Blue Book people and, like, all of these, like, sporadic researchers of UFOs. There's, like, a lot of information here and there. And, like, we kind of have siloed information. So I think my book kind of mirrors that human experience. You read through this and you have, okay, so this is this lens from the perspective of this person, from perspective of JFK, of perspective of these fictional and kind of real historic characters. You know, I kind of walk in their experiences and then sort of like it comes together.
I see.
Like,
yeah.
The veil is being lifted. For our understanding.
Uh-huh. So I'll remind, if anyone wants to call in, that number's up on the screen. And I did notice that this book has a lot of five-star ratings. You have a lot of really good ratings. A lot of people love the book.
I'm just thrilled.
That must be a thrilling for your first book.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you never know. It's a little bit of an unconventional type of a narrative. Like I said, it has, I would say, experimental style, narrative style, you know. So I didn't know if people would catch on to that, if that would be. But when folks started explaining, started to say that it's a sci-fi epic and it's on hard sci-fi side, and like I could not be thrilled more, because like to me, to say like this is kind of like in the hard sci-fi camp, I was like, oh my god, that's like, you know, being at the feet of the giants of fiction. You know, that's just awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so are you actually writing sort of like a follow-up book on the book? Is that what you said you're doing?
Yeah, there's going to be a second book, 329 Years of War. Looking forward to have it out by the end of the year, if all goes well. So
wow.
So, it's not going to be a never-ending series, because I want to write, and I have manuscripts of other stories, but I think it warrants for another book, at least, to serve, really give this universe a conclusion.
Yeah. Do you, you know, it seems like all books and all movies that project the future, it's always dystopian. Everything is, you know, falling apart. We're conquered or whatever by something, by AI. And then you hear someone like, I think Hawking might have even said something about artificial intelligence. And Elon Musk thinks it's, you know, could possibly be the destruction of us all. What do you think about artificial intelligence in the future?
Oh, this is more in the camp of my those manuscripts that I mentioned, my different series, which is cyberpunk dystopian type of stuff that deals with clones and AI and just you know, again, it's a very existential probe into what is a person, what is a human, is clone a human? When an AI becomes a person, when it becomes self-aware. Generally, I'm in the Musk camp. Maybe that's just my personality. I have a healthy dose of paranoia in me for good reasons. I mean, look at the world. I mean, you don't really, you know, it's not like everything everywhere is perfect, you know?
Yeah.
I think the problem is that we have rogue nations, and every nation is a rogue nation in the field of science and discovery, to be honest. China is doing its own thing. United States is doing its own thing. Military of any country is doing its entirely own thing. And then there is Russia and the biological and nuclear threats and all of that stuff. And the lack of, forget even ethical standards, like even treaties on these subjects that would be binding and common sense. Like, look what was happening with the global warming treaties. Seems like we would kind of be concerned about the planet we're living on. But again, I understand big business is never easy to deal with. So I think big business and technology will definitely run our lives. Don't look any further than Facebook, what was happening recently. It's not like we did not know that the data is being gathered. We did not know that the AI exists. AI exists. What it is not to our knowledge, it's not self-aware as of yet, or so we think.
That will be the scary day,
but
when it becomes self-aware.
Because Because I tell you, no AI will have AI will not read science fiction. AI will not, you know, AI will not have all those ridiculous weaknesses that humans have. You know, like what makes us human makes us flawed, makes us weak.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, I just cannot grasp, you know, that Sophie, robot that was granted the Saudi Arabian citizenship, it's very faint AI at this point. It doesn't really do a whole lot. It's a talking doll, but I'm just having a hard time to see how a being like that would have compassion. I think it would be a completely rational entity, and we would be like a pestilence on this planet in the eyes of this type of being.
You know?
When, like a total destruction, nonsense, nuisance.
Could very well happen. Yeah, I've had conversations with my son about this type of thing and how, you know, you're right. When there's no emotions involved in this, you know, it could go just to rational, and rational is not always the right answer. Like going all the way back to, I'm trying to remember that movie, Wars or something like that with Matthew Broderick. The computer goes wild and, you know, it just thinks to stop the threat. That's all it thinks of. It doesn't think about these are people and it was going to destroy the world. And then he had it play the tic-tac-toe game where it realized it couldn't win. War Games, I think that was the name of that movie. But, I mean, going all the way back to that and several others, you know, that's like artificial intelligence, the theory of the future of it. We have a call coming in, but it's not, for some reason, this Skype is not allowing me to join it. Because I had to redo all my applications, and one of them was Skype. And so I'm sorry, caller, I can't take your call. There's no, sorry about that.
Sorry.
So, caller.
Sorry about that.
Unfortunately, we can't take calls on this show. I'll try to figure that out by next show. But please do put your question in the chat, and I will relay it along. Yeah, someone corrected me. It was War Games. Terminator, that's another one. I thought that was, that's kind of, and that's, I think we're sort of heading in that direction if we're not careful, where, you know, that something could be on just, you know, self-perpetuating and then do whatever. I mean, these are possibilities. It's scary possibilities, but definitely possibilities.
Yeah. And I am in Elon Musk's team, I suppose, because there was this Musk versus Zuckerberg debate some time ago that kind of went pretty public. And Zuckerberg was saying that, no, AI is our friend, technology is our friend, all's chill. Look where Zuckerberg testifying before the Congress because of that type of thinking. Like big data. So if you read about AIs, the type of AI, you can do several things. How you can make an AI. You can either reconstruct a neural pathway, like to imitate a brain in a certain way, or with already pre-programmed certain knowledge or logical rules of operation, or you make it a learning machine. And a learning machine needs data. It learns on big data. And like what is happening with accumulation of big data these days is one of the scariest things, in my opinion. Not because of only privacy and identity theft, but just because I think we are completely unaware of the scale of how much big data exists, how, you know, consumer choices are, you know, like economy is driven on big data, elections are driven on big data. Like, we don't, it's a whole brave new world and it exploded in the past 10 years or so with the advent of Facebook and platforms like that.
Well, also, another thing when it comes to, say, just for instance, Facebook. Okay, we're talking 2 billion people are on Facebook. Think about all the power that they could have, possibly, like, not that they would, not that anyone would, but just think if, like, a madman took over Facebook. Like, all of a sudden it was under hostage, and the messages that could get out to 2 billion people could cause absolute chaos. I mean, not that it would ever happen, but it's just, the possibilities are there when there's that type of control over that many people.
Remember when in Hawaii there was a false alert about the nuclear strike?
Yeah. Yeah, I know someone
that wouldn't be such a big of a deal, except these days everybody has a smartphone in the pocket with connection to the internet. And, like, information like this goes viral. And, of course, like now with the information sharing, like, even that aspect, like, leave alone propaganda and manipulation of masses, although that is quite a scary thing because, like, we were talking about bipartisan adversarial kind of nature of politics in our society, like the tribal split. Think about how scary it is that can you be so sure that what you're thinking is actually what you're thinking? Because your thoughts come from the, like, environment around you, and the stuff you're getting is less and less like journalism. It's more opinion pieces, you know. You're getting a certain regurgitated. You're not getting nutrition. You're getting a protein shake. You know, you're not getting a meal, a wholesome meal, where you can just kind of pick apart.
Right.
Yeah, it's very philosophical. I don't know. It just gets me thinking.
No. I like this conversation. A question that the caller was trying to call in had was he says that you have mentioned JFK, are we talking the president or the assassination? He's just trying to figure out what you're referencing, what you reference in that book.
Okay, so what I'm referencing is, if you think of Cloud Atlas, and I mentioned it, so it's like a lot of pieces of puzzles come together. But from point of view of JFK, who was born in 1917, coincidentally the same year where Our Lady Fatima sighting happened, like across the world. So I picked certain pieces of history, like, for example, I picked 1942, where the LA sighting happened, and I was like, okay, where JFK was back in the day? He was in the Office of Naval Intelligence during his military, and so I won't tell how, but I incorporated the, because he as a, what's the word? Military personnel, like he would be aware of things like that, because that was perceived as an external threat from Japan or whatnot, you know. So he would be aware of this incident. Then in 52, when he was already a congressman.
52.
So I basically, I think he was running for Senate that year. Because Nixon was running for president, and I have Nixon as well in there. So I basically looked at all of these actors and where they were at certain pieces of, at certain points in time, and these UFO incidents. So that also was a mass sighting, and like he had enough classified, or he would be connecting the dots. Then he takes the office in 61, if I'm remembering correctly.
62. Oh, you mean presidents? As a president, yes, so, 61.
Yeah, and so he gets exposure to the full classified information of everything that is going on. And we shall go to the moon, not because it's hard, but, you know, not because it's easy, but because it's hard and all of that. vision happens, you know. So I was just kind of trying to put myself into his shoes, and then of course assassination, and again it's an what if exercise. What if aliens are here? What if JFK, we know, was pretty darn brilliant guy. He like speed read, and his like comprehension level was out of this world, and he also was plagued by a lot of autoimmune deficiencies, and actually his entire family had like Ted Kennedy died from brain tumor. So, and that's all the byproducts of oscillation. So you get my drift. This is a family that has the gene. Mm-hmm. So, and it's just I don't know, this kind of book wrote itself. I took history and I just kept untangling what if. And of course, what if aliens are involved in the human history and JFK has the gene of oscillation, and what if the CIA finds out? What if the CIA finds out that basically aliens are keeping the sitting president alive because he's basically falling apart? We didn't.
Right. He had very bad health.
Back then it became declassified. We saw that he was a strongman type of guy, but he was very deeply ill all the time on medication.
A lot of medication. So, yeah.
Yeah. So what if CIA and finds out that the president is basically compromised by staying alive with the help of the aliens? And what if actually the governments know about the aliens? Imagine like all the governments know about the presence of aliens. Like I only imagine, you know, the highest level of officials, presidents and VPs, and you know, people who have the highest classified access to classified information. What do you do with that type of information? Like, I mean, what would you do? Like, okay, you already lost the war. You haven't even started it. Now are you going to cause panic in the world? You might as well just like pick apart the wreckage and come up with the internet or something like that, you know. I think our commercialism and our, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you wake up next to a snake. Like, what do? Like, I mean, you don't start like screaming and kicking. You let it sleep. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Someone wanted to know, do you have a favorite UFO case? Incident? Is there one that you would call your favorite?
Well, these ones that I put in, they're pretty darn favorite. The one that I haven't mentioned, though, that is in the book also, is in 1986, there was this incident with the commercial flight that was flying over Alaska from Paris to Tokyo.
Yeah, JAL 1625 or whatever it is. Yeah,
and that is like one hell of a interesting case as well,
right?
Because, you know, like people on board saw... basically, there was a case of a mothership and then little ships, and they were all hovering around this aircraft, and there was like intense light, so there was like some kind of radiation. And that, just when I read that case, I was like, holy shit, that just like fits into my narrative because of what aliens are doing, what type of projects they are doing. They're like, you know, radiating, treating basically our cancers and whatnot in high profile carriers of the oscillation gene. So, you know, where do you get a hold of them? Like on the airplane, you know, you find out that somebody's on the airplane. It's very easy. You just go over there, you know, you disperse some radiation or some kind of treatment, or, well, this is just how it fit together, how it came together in my book.
Yeah.
So that was a very interesting case.
I agree. That's one of my favorites. Just to think that it was a 30 year pilot with an A+ record, And, you know, he's seeing what he can't believe, this big, large, walnut-shaped thing, the size of, like, two airplanes in front of him. And then, like you said, the smaller things coming out. It's tracked on radar for 300 miles. The thing goes around him, you know, circles around him.
Yeah.
And he's trying to describe it, and he's trying to sound normal. And then he gets a desk job. You know, he's no longer, he couldn't fly anymore after that. Eventually that he was brought back to flying again. But, I mean, for, I think, 2 years, he couldn't fly after that incident, which is pretty sad. And
In my book, I reinterpret it as, again, like, what if? So there is this case.
Yeah.
What if government knows about these stunts and it's like, the government needs to this pilot to keep quiet about the experience. And so I kind of reimagined, and there's the whole incident. I transcribed the whole conversation with the Anchorage, the ground air traffic controllers, and then the Reagan administration people got involved, you know, and all of that. So kind of like every time I got this piece of history, I was trying to like vividly put myself in, like, see what was happening, what was actively happening in the moment.
Wow. All right. Well, we're right at the end of our show here. Do you want to give out your website and all that information?
EllieMaloney.com.
Okay.
Ellie Maloney is my name.
Yep.
You can find me on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. There is either that or a search for 329 Years Awake. There's accounts for that as well. And feel free to shoot me a question if you want. If any of that was not covered, or just, you know, let me know if you ever pick up the book, let me know what you think. To hear your thoughts.
Okay, well, it's a real pleasure, and I really appreciate you staying up to the wee hours of the morning over there. I hope you can fall
asleep. Well, hey, I'm
wide
awake now, and my coffee was out a long time ago, so I'm excited. I was energized. Thank you for that.
All right. Okay, everyone. All right, so thanks so much, and I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, Martin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right, everyone. So that is it for the show. I appreciate you hanging in with us. Next week, we have Jason Cleaves, another person we're going to be talking to over in the UK, and that should be a great show. Looking forward to that. Thanks so much for listening. Or if you're a supporter of the show, I want to thank you, and also thank some people that helped us out tonight. Alejandro Rojas with the UFO updates. I want to thank Jordan Bonaparte for the first part of the show. Our guest, Ellie Maloney. I also want to thank Evan for producing the show. And we will get that Skype thing fixed and be able to take calls next week. I also want to thank Peggy for managing the Facebook page, and Keith over at the Dark Matter Digital Network. All right, everyone, so thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.